Well, as he said, my name is Randy. I'm the program director of the Ibogaine Association, which is a treatment center down in Mexico. And you'll have to forgive me, being on Burning Man time, my brain isn't functioning at perfect speed right now. So if I stutter or talk a little slow or slur, please forgive me. Who knows what Ibogaine is? Okay. But we'll start with what is Ibogaine. Then I'll tell a little about myself, a little about our treatment center. Sandra will talk about her work, and Valerie will talk about her work, and then we'll take questions. And I suppose we could take questions in the middle too, if you'd like to. So, Ibogaine is a natural substance. It comes from the Tabernath Iboga, which is a tree that grows in the Gabon in West Africa, near the Congo. And in the root bark of this tree is this medicine, Ibogaine. And Ibogaine is a powerful psychedelic drug. And they've been using it there as a rite of passage. Can you guys hear me okay? Yeah. So they've been using the Ibogaine or the Iboga root bark as a rite of passage for thousands of years. And it's part of a tribe called the Bwiti. B-W-I-T-I. In the 1960s, a gentleman by the name of Howard Lotsoff, who was a heroin addict at the time and also enjoyed his psychedelics, got his hands on Ibogaine, not really knowing what he was getting into. And he serendipitously found out that when he came off of his Ibogaine experience, he didn't have much withdrawal from the heroin, and he lost his desire to use it. And since then, he tried to bring it forward, and the surge in popularity to bring Ibogaine to drug addicts has really taken off. At our treatment center, we've been around for about 4 years now, and we've done over 350 treatments. And I would guess that there are several thousand other treatments that have taken place across North America where people are seeking this out to defeat their addictions. You want to add anything to that before I tell you a personal bit? You're just listening. This is Sandra Carpetas. Everybody say hi to Sandra.
Hello, everybody.
Now, I got into Ibogaine because I used to have a dope habit. And I tried several things to kick the dope, and nothing seemed to work for me. And I just kept on running around the country, and everywhere I ended up there, I was, in the bad neighborhood shooting dope. And fortunately for myself, I found the doctors that I work for now. They were in Mexico City at the time. And in July of 2001, so a little over 3 years ago, I went down to Mexico City, and I took Ibogaine under the care of these doctors. And I kicked my habit, which was a miracle. Where did you lose me at? So I said that 3 years ago, I took Ibogaine in Mexico City with the doctors that I work for to kick my heroin habit. And it worked very well for me. So I'll try to indulge you a little bit in what the experience was like. But as I'm sure many of you know from being an entheogen enthusiast, until you do it yourself, it really doesn't make any sense. Ibogaine is not a recreational high. I guess I meet some people that enjoy it. I would not put it on the pleasant side of things. For me, I went down to Mexico City very, very excited to take Ibogaine. I was like, I'm going to kick my heroin habit and take a crazy psychedelic drug. This, what could get better?
One session.
Yeah. And when the doctors, warned me that, it's not really fun, I kind of shrugged my shoulders. They don't know what they're talking about. They're inexperienced. I have experience. Well, it wasn't fun, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. When I first took it, I lay down in bed, and I started to go to sleep. And I took it orally. The Ibogaine that we work with is Ibogaine hydrochloride. So it's manufactured, and we can get out just the hydrochloride. If you were to take it in Africa, you can eat lots of root bark. that they're going to shred and powder up and feed it to you in some other version. So you have to eat a lot of it. But with modern medicine, we can just give you a little pill. 15 to 20 milligrams per kilogram would be a healthy dose. LD50, like what's the most you want to take? You know, I've heard different rumors on that, but I don't have an answer. I wouldn't advise doing that. The 50 milligrams per kilogram, that would be pretty intense, if not fatal. It'd be easier to overdose on the root bark. That makes sense. However, I don't hear many stories. Of course, I've never been to Africa, so I don't know really what's going on over there, but I don't hear the stories. I think that you're eating it so slowly in Africa, they know that you know, when you've gotten enough. Because it's hard to eat. I hear it's the worst tasting crap.
You have to eat a lot of it. And in some ceremonies, they do. You know, these are the rite of passage. It's quite an initiation, right? And from what I understand, how they work is that they, in the initiation, in the rite of passage, what they're looking for is the level to which a person has come, the levels that they've reached in their experience. And from what I understand, in the Bwiti rituals, the community sits there with them or sings during the experience and pays attention to what's going on with the initiate. And often the initiate is asked to communicate what they are experiencing. And they have a cultural and symbolical understanding of Iboga and its use as an initiation rite, as a rite of passage. And what they're looking to do is to break through to new levels, to connect with spirit, to connect with their cultural heritage, their ancestry. And, the term breaking open the head, Daniel Pinchbeck used that as a title for his book. They're looking to initiate themselves into a deeper level of awareness or understanding of who they are and how they fit in. They can seek to go very deep with that. And from what I understand, it is the role of the sitters to pay attention to where they're at, to inquire about that, and to, in a sense, facilitate them, or in that perspective, maybe even guide them towards seeking out different levels of the experience through, symbols and cultural understanding to help them to go further. So I have heard of, although I don't really know, to be honest, but I've heard that they can get to some quite high doses. The rituals can last for very long periods of time. With and the Bwiti is also a very large cult. There are many different sects, and there's also syncretic, which means that there's also syncretic churches, which are mixing Christianity and Bwiti and the older ancestral cult, and so they all do it differently. I've heard of some ceremonies that take up to 3 weeks just in preparation, setting the intention for the experience. The number of different symbolical ceremonies or ritual that the dosing itself can last up to 3 days, where they eat the root bark that's been pulverized, powdered, sometimes mixed with plantain. I just found out recently from Giorgio Samarini they also use a plant called Alan, which he's studying, and he's currently, Giorgio Samarini studied for 10 years with the Bwiti.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I'm still waiting to find
the question out. Was, does he mix, do the Bwiti mix the salam, is that how you said it?
The alan with the iboga. They do, the syncretic religion, at least I know, some of the syncretic churches do mix it. I don't know if they do it in the same dosing or if it's a different set of initiations. I forget the name. I might even have it in here somewhere, written down in my notes.
What was the question again, please?
It's hard to hear me.
Okay, go back to my experience. Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Questions for the end.
So back to my experience. So when I took the ibogaine, I lay down in bed and I went into this very pleasant dreamlike state. And the first thing that occurred to me was a very pleasant memory of being with my family when I was very young. So we're talking 4 or 5 years old, pleasant around the dinner table memories, everybody laughing. And when I came out of that, you know, subconsciousness and brought it back to me, I was like, wow, this is really nice, you know. And I'd heard so much about how the ibogaine, you know, takes you back. And as quickly as it was pleasant, it instantly turned rather chaotic. And lots of people who take ibogaine will talk about meeting iboga, who is the god of ibogaine, or the deity, I suppose. And it comes in several different forms. For me, the iboga god looked more like a Mayan face that danced around in circles and is very sun-like, and he would cackle and he would come into my face and stick his tongue out at me and wave his fingers at me and taunt me. You know, he really taunted me quite a bit. And it was very loud. And I started hearing African drumming. And I heard howling in my ears. And then I would see other images, and they'd be like still life images. I'd see a picture of myself as a child, holding hands with my brother and my dad, and it would come from far away in a dot, and it would travel and pass over my shoulder. And then I would see another image of my mom when she was young and her hair was still long, and then it would pass and come over my shoulder again. And as this experience went, I started to lose myself more, and I traveled out of my body and back in time, back to Africa. And my understanding is that the African experience is relatively common, whether or not you're in Africa or not. I'm curious to know whether it was I predisposed to have an African experience, or was it really in the entity of the medicine that gave me the African experience? But I went back to the time when I was a hunter and I traveled with my tribe, and I was in peace then. It was before we had the difficulties of modern civilization. I was able to remember what it was like to be close to God, to not be burdened with addiction, to, you know, to find nature. You know, we would go on a hunt together and we live as a family, as a unit. And then I traveled back into this time, and I saw the streets of Denver, and I saw the streets of Detroit, where I used to walk and do my thing. And I was able to realize how hard it had been for me to find God and to find peace with myself in these streets. One of the things I talk about is, if you go back in time a few thousand years, or really just 100 years, you're not going to find hypodermic syringes. And this was a big plague for me. So this was a very chaotic experience, and it became very redundant too. The iboga guy would go around again, and I'd go back in time again and come back forward again. And I suppose a lot of it I would forget at the time, and it comes back to me later on. And just as intense as it was and how quickly it had become chaotic, it suddenly stopped too. After about 4 to 6 hours, it just, all the noise stopped, or at least the visual noise. The auditorial noise continued for like 20 hours or so. And I was in Mexico City. If you guys have been down to Mexico City, it's full of VW bugs. So outside of my clinic window, I'm hearing these VW bugs going by, and it's just raging in my ear. I had expected that the ibogaine would be much like my early LSD experiences, where I had these instant epiphanies, where I was going to go into my head and find out why it was I was an addict. You know, what was it? You know, and that's what had been advertised to me on the internet. Oh, take ibogaine and you'll find out exactly why you're a drug addict. And I was sitting there and, you know, trying to brainwash myself. You know, why am I an addict and how can I stop myself from being an addict? But the answers I got weren't an epiphany. It wasn't like, ta-da, this is why. It was like, well, this is stuff you already knew. You already knew that, you know, you were unhappy with your childhood, that you wanted more from your life, and, you know, you had low self-esteem, etc. What was interesting about, and I'm going to jump forward a little bit, there wasn't an epiphany in those hours I took the ibogaine. The epiphany came about 3 weeks to a month later, when I had gone that long without getting high, which was very unusual for me. And I didn't understand how I did it. I didn't understand how come I was able to call my drug dealer with full intention on scoring. And when he answered the phone, I say to him, I just got back from Mexico, the ibogaine worked, and I hung up. It doesn't make any sense. I had some desire. You know, I had a really heavy habit. I don't know if anybody's here has ever had experiences being dependent to opiates or has had friends on opiates. Does it only work for chemical substance addiction? No. It's great for it because there's a biological component, which I'll talk about in a moment. Treatmenters are using ibogaine for all kinds of addiction. It depends upon, you know, what their choice is. But I'll get to that in a second. It does take away most of the physical withdrawal, but that didn't mean that I felt great afterwards. In fact, I felt like a weak little boy. And it took me several weeks before I returned to health and started to get my energy back. So, you know, when you're not sleeping at night and you're physically fatigued and you know that you can just go score some heroin and you'll feel better, of course you have the thoughts. But for some reason, I was not doing that. The other thing I really found was that while I hadn't found out anything new about myself, I brought all these suppressed memories forward to work with. You know, things like the childhood stuff, the parenting stuff. And I was able to sort through it. Like, my head was very, very busy for weeks at a time, was just going over and over trying to make sense of these things that happened to me and make sense of how my head was shooken up from the ibogaine. And it allowed me to, you know, to really be insightful, and it was the best catalyst for change that's ever happened for me. Here, ask the question here again.
No, I was just, there's a common habit that people have, that fantasizing about their childhood from a position of being able to know what you know now, and that this might be like a push through the rear view of your mind where you get to do that.
I'd have to say everybody's probably different, but for me, my childhood really wasn't all that bad, you know, and I'm sitting here pretending that my childhood was bad. So that's what, you know, really helped me, is that, you know, Randy, you know, cut the shit, you know, so what, your parents got divorced, you know, it happens to 50% of us.
So it changed your interpretation?
Yeah, it changed my interpretation. It allowed me to heal it. And to stop, you know, carrying it around like a burden. Because for years I walked around saying, oh, I'm such a bad kid, and, you know, I just have low expectations, of, you know, when I got into dope, I lost my expectations of myself. I had high expectations before I did dope, but the dope quickly took those things away. Did I ever return to dope? No. Yeah, absolutely. One of the great things for me in my life with the Ibogaine is I honestly believe that I act and behave today as if I had never done the heroin. To me, it's a story. You know, I can tell stories. I can, you know, tell stories that you guys don't have about my experiences. But there's nothing there for me anymore. I'm nothing. I'm not sitting around going, "Oh, I'm scared of dope." I'm not scared of it. It's behind me. And I found no other treatment way able to get me there so quickly. I think you can do it without Ibogaine, but it takes a lot of work. And I think the Ibogaine's a great jog to the head to get you going with that. I've only done Ibogaine once. I have not tried ayahuasca. I've smoked the DMT. Sir? Well, yeah, when I talk about dope, I mean heroin. So... when I was doing the treatment, like I was aware of where I was. Like I was very in my body. It didn't have the euphoria that you get from psilocybin or LSD, where you really lose yourself if you take a whole lot. And I was very aware. I'm lying in a bed in Mexico City. And I'm going to close my eyes now. That's one of the things about Ibogaine hallucinations. It's more of a vision quest in a dream state. But you don't open your eyes and see all these things. With your eyes open, you'll see flickers of light. You know, maybe a little bit of imagery. It's when you close your eyes that you really have the experience. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. You know, one of the things that we tell our patients is to, you know, if you don't like what you're seeing, you know, open your eyes and blink and you can change it.
Also, I need to remind them too to, you know, try not to also be too much in denial of what you're seeing as well. Like to pay attention to that, but that if it's getting difficult or harrowing, that you can stop and reflect and take a moment and just, or change it if you wish. Yeah. Have I tried it? Yes.
Has anybody else in the room tried Ibogaine? Does my experience seem to resemble any of your experiences? Is it very different?
Rick, you also...
Well, Rick, you mixed it with LSD too, right?
Yes.
Yeah. My session was not guided, and at our treatment center, they're not guided. I think Sandra probably does more guidance at hers.
Well,
it depends on how you look at me. Well, Ibogaine's so introspective. You lie down in bed. You know, it's hard to talk. I mean, in the Bwiti in Africa, they force you to talk. But, well, the intense part's 4 to 8 hours, but you'll feel the drug for 24 to 36 hours. That'd be false. Right.
About the 7 days, I have heard reports of it lasting up to 7 days with a single dose, and as far as I know, it's only happened with women. I know of twice it's happened in England.
Well, when they had 7 days, were they tripping 7 days or having flickers of light?
It sounded like they were tripping out pretty hard for 7 days. Like they couldn't leave the facility.
We had one woman who also tripped for about 4 days. That was long. That was at about 17 milligrams per kilogram. She was light, very small and frail.
And I have heard of people tell me, you know, a week later they're still seeing flickers of light, but I haven't encountered these instances.
Yeah.
The question is the longer and stronger the experience, is it related to how much change there is? Yeah, there was a change. I don't know if I knew it right away. It came about slowly. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the experience itself can last for different periods for different people, right? There's a number of different factors that I think we need to look into. But the reintegration of the experience for some can take a long time, too. To find the definite place where the experience ends is a little blurry.
Go ahead, Rick.
I've heard of people who've gotten their ass kicked. I've seen some people get their ass kicked. But you know, it's through our greatest challenges that we discover our greatest skills and talents.
One of the things I think about the Ibo game, because it is difficult, and when we're talking about treating drug addicts like things easy. Even though their lives are hard, it's easy to get high. It's easier to get high than it is to, you know, try to clean up your act. And if you put somebody through an experience like ibogaine that's so difficult, they're going to come back the other side and they're going to feel stronger about themselves. Yeah. The thing about surrendering?
People who I've met, people who are users and have chosen to actively be users and want to and understand the consequences for themselves and yet continue to choose to use. It's a very, very rare individual, but I've met them.
Well, to come back to your question where we're trying to figure out, is the more powerful experience, does it have more results in drug addiction treatment? I don't know that we know the answer to that yet, and that's kind of why Valerie's up here. And so maybe it's a great prelude for Valerie to give a quick or a long talk about what she's doing.
Maybe not too long. I'm Valerie, and I work for MAPS. MAPS is the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And I'm working with Randy and Sandra to follow up their subjects for 1 year following treatment to see how well the treatment works. Right now, there isn't very much long-term data on ibogaine treatment for drug addiction. It follows there is some information about other kinds of psychedelics being used for drug addiction. It's called the redemptive model. And across cultures, the Navajo use peyote sometimes to treat alcoholism. Bill Wilson, who founded Alcoholics Anonymous, used LSD, so there's some evidence that psychedelics can be used.
Ayahuasca.
Yeah, and there's ayahuasca, and that's being used right now. There's some clinics like that.
Ketamine.
So basically, my study, we're trying to figure out, does ibogaine work for drug addiction, and who does it work for? And we're doing this by giving a variety of surveys to measure different things about the person who goes into the experience and their personal habit and the depth of their ibogaine experience and how that relates to their recovery. So we're measuring a lot of factors to try to figure out which people get better and predict that. Because it does work for some people, and then it doesn't work for others. Those things are measured at the clinic, but it's not a part of the outcome study. right now. And in addition to information from these clinics, we're getting data from some other Ibogaine clinics as well. There's one in California that we're gathering data at, and that's they're treating people for behavioral addictions rather than drug addictions. It's in California. I can't give any more information than that. So that'll be interesting to find out how it works for non-drug addictions. And then we're also working to behavioral addictions like food, sex, relationships. And then we're also working with a treatment provider in England to do a study where we actually administer the Ibogaine as part of the study, whereas in this one, the clinics are administering the Ibogaine and I'm going in as a separate entity and studying how they're doing. And I'm working to get the study approved by an IRB so it can go into a legitimate medical journal and it can be searched and looked at by doctors and researchers. And another good thing about the study is that it gives the providers a chance to share information through me because I'm in contact with a bunch of different people. So when something comes up, then I can tell the other people about it. And it also gives the clients an opportunity to talk to someone for a whole year after treatment, whereas before they might not have the chance to talk to someone for quite as long. Any more questions about the study right now? I don't have any preliminary results. I think, Sandra, do you have the, can I see that? Okay, this is, going back to before the time when we started doing the official outcome study, which hasn't officially started yet everywhere either. For the people who used, that's better. This is information from the Iboga Therapy House in Vancouver. Of 20 people that had been treated, 65% were abstinent at the time when we counted them. And
5 weeks ago. 7 weeks ago.
This information isn't totally accurate for how long they stay sober, though, because this is information that we counted, I think, 5 weeks ago, the last of the 7 weeks ago. 7 weeks ago, the last person had been treated up to 2 years ago. So this is 65% of these people, but some of them had only been treated 5 weeks ago, and some of them had been treated 2 years ago.
No, that's the 20 people, so that would be up to a year ago.
Up to a year. Okay, so this is 5 weeks up to a year. 13 of them out of 20, 65% were abstinent at the time we counted them. But then we went back and counted the people who had been treated over 6 months ago, and we didn't really have very many people, it looks like, but about between 25 and 75% were abstinent, which is a big number, but we really had a small pool here, and I'm guessing it's going to be about half, which is a lot better than other treatments. Across the board, it's about 10%.
We have some people that have remained abstinent from substances like methadone for a year.
Raphael asked, what's the recidivism rate? And informally, my guess is that 30 to 40% of the patients do very well. I think that 95% of the people who take it benefit in some way. Whether they return to active use or not. And there's just a small percentage of people who don't benefit because they put all their eggs in the basket. And then when it doesn't work for them, they come out the other side and everything's falling apart. Over here. Regular treatments boast 10-20%. I would say the first two. They don't continue to work on themselves. They don't have the support structure. The word that we use for Ibogaine is an addiction interrupter. So we don't. I don't like to call it a cure. I don't think that's fair, and it gives people a, you know, some expectation of it that it's not. Ibogaine is a great catalyst for change. If you are determined, you need to put these things in place. You can't just come and take Ibogaine and go back to the streets. You're going to go back to using. In the back.
Do you guys encourage people to reuse the substance?
Do we encourage them to reuse Ibogaine? Some do. At our treatment center, we don't necessarily encourage them. The ones that want to come back. I know of other treatmenters. Howard, for instance, I often see him encouraging people to do it multiple times. Please. The question is, what do you do at the clinic if somebody takes their dose and keeps throwing it up? Well, we give an anti-nausea medication before the Ibogaine anyhow. It's not often that we experience that. I suppose that you could do an anal suppository, but we've never had to.
You can also wait.
You have to forgive me because I don't perform the treatments and I don't know the name of the medication. How much does the treatment cost? At our treatment center, the basic treatment is $3,300. And if you're on methadone, it's $4,500.
Ours is absolutely free of charge to those who... Ours is located in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada. It's offered free of charge, but we have a... Our program is offered absolutely free of charge to those who qualify, or, well, let me qualify that by saying that our screening process includes one that looks into a number of different factors for the reason of helping to support these people into getting to a place where they're ready to make this change in their lives. So we're both looking for where they're at and where they want to be, and that includes a number of different factors such as nutrition, education, family, social support, sense of self-worth, and through the screening process we open dialogue with these people about where they're at, and if we feel that they may not be ready, then our task is then to help support them to get to a place where they may be ready for that. Because it's not, like Randy said, it's not, I think it's dangerous to consider it a quick fix or a miracle cure. And many people call us to inquire about it have understood that about it. And so the idea is to help prepare them for a very powerful experience. Not only a very powerful experience with the psychedelic, but also a deep look at the self and a look at what can be done in their own lives to make the changes that they feel are necessary to be in a healthy state. Right now, because of the study, we're treating people who are chemically dependent to heroin, methadone, crack, cocaine, alcohol, and we might try a few more methamphetamine and other opiates and painkillers.
It's also fair to say that while they do it free of charge, they're only able to treat one person a week, and only Canadians, and they're temporarily closed.
We're temporarily closed. We've taken a bit of a break throughout the summer. Our program has been through a number of different challenges, but I feel that with those challenges, however, we've been very successful in finding out what it really is going to take from us to have a better program, and so we're constantly trying to improve our program. We're starting again in October.
It's fascinating work because there's nobody before us that set out and said, this is how to run ibogaine treatment centers, that gave us a roadmap to follow. So independently, we've, you know, tried to figure this out ourselves, and it's challenging. It's difficult work. It's a difficult group of people to deal with. It's difficult to remain funded to do it. Right.
It's a different context, though. I think your question is if we can learn something from the cultural, traditional use of iboga in our programs. I think we can, but it's also important to note that some people come to us not with a spiritual inclination, although sometimes they discover that, that people are coming there essentially to get well. And everybody is different, and I think programs like ours need to take into account those differences, the needs of the individuals that come in, and you know, approaching that from a place of tolerance and respect and support. And I'm sure that there is much that can be learned from the Bwiti, but there isn't that much known to us about how they conduct their ceremony.
And I wouldn't suggest sending a heroin addict to the Bwiti to try to get well.
Yeah, it's, you know, some come in to get treated, and they're not looking for a spiritual exploration. And so it's really important to not try to color somebody's experience. If they're open to talking about that, and definitely I open dialogue about the Bwiti and how they use the medicine, and if they're interested in talking about that more, then dialogue ensues. If not, then we don't push it. It's, with any kind of psychedelic, it's important not to, to color somebody's experience with your own I'll just leave it there.
In the back here again.
Yeah, we just go. I hope it's been used for thousands of years, but my understanding is that there's no evidence that people used it later on hundreds of years ago.
The question is that I said that ibogaine has been used for thousands of years, and he says that he heard there was no evidence of it being used less than 150 years ago. I'm not going to be able to answer that question. I don't know if you guys have an answer.
Do you mean by the Bwiti?
Well, the French discovered it.
Does it matter?
No, not really.
Well,
but in regards to his question,
history is important, definitely, and I think we need to learn more about that. I know that apparently the iboga was brought to the Bwiti by pygmies, and there hasn't been very much contact with them specifically around iboga, so we don't really know how long it's been used.
Please. The question is there a relationship between spiritual experience and outcome? And I'm going to have to go back to that. We're trying to find the answer. I've seen great successes in people who had no visionary journey. And they,
I think it's also important to define spiritual, you know. We're currently using some diagnostic tools such as
peak experience profile.
Thank you. And we also use Strassman's hallucinogen rating scale, which we find is really a really interesting post-integration tool, because it asks questions that are specifically directed at spiritual or mystical experience or transpersonal experience beyond the personal. And it's an attempt to try and define that or measure it a little bit. It's been very useful. These tools have been very useful in that sometimes trying to describe the experience can be very difficult because it's not only a very long experience, but there's a lot of context to be delivered. So the questions that are posed often help people to start talking about those sorts of things, whereas that may not have been a part of their mindset previously, but it's another sort of lens with which to filter through information about that.
The peak experience profile is a 200 question survey, and it was developed by Walter Penke for the Good Friday experiments, and it measures a whole bunch of things, the perinatal matrix as well as the peaks and the lows of the experience, and we're using that in the study. I think it'll be really useful for diagnosing that kind of thing and measuring.
I want to touch again on the defining spiritual too. We all define that in different ways, and some may not use the term spiritual, may have a positive experience, and somehow it helps to improve their quality of life or helps them to look at something that goes a little deeper beyond the self. Integration
the comment is
important and ongoing.
I'm going to get to some of the other questions. I'm excited by your guys' intrigue here. We'll start here. The question is, I've never tried ayahuasca, but I have tried DMT. Right. My DMT experience was after the Ibogaine experience. It was probably a good year or two afterwards. It was brown DMT that you smoke. It came from my dealer. I think it's the first one. It wasn't. The intensity is similar, but I found the DMT, not my first DMT experience, but my second one when I got used to it, to be much more pleasant and enjoyable, and much more euphoric, where it took me away in a different way. It's kind of a long question. I'm going to try to repeat it, so because we're recording this. So, did the pain of the Ibogaine experience outweigh the pain of being an addict? They're just two different pains, and I don't know why I would use the word pain for the Ibogaine experience. It was challenging. It was very tough. It was very arduous. Painful? No. Scary, yeah. And you know, by the time I did the DMT, it was so long after. I mean, I found the DMT very therapeutic, but I didn't relate it. I'll tell you what I did have an experience was relatively recently. I don't smoke pot very often. Well, I smoke it, but not in large amounts. Just a little bit at the end of the day or something. And it was on one of these festivals, and I wake up, I'm smoking, and usually if you wake up and you start smoking, you can smoke throughout the day and it doesn't really knock you down. And I happened upon this guy that had some really powerful marijuana, And when I, you know, and I'm so dumb, I take like four hits of it. And I ended up in my tent staring at the ceiling, you know, just being miserable and going, this is as close as I've been to Ibogaine, you know, since I've done it. So that would be, I mean, if you, you guys probably fathom those experiences when you just overdo the marijuana and you're like knocked down. Go ahead.
I have a question back there.
What's your opinion on the application?
The question is, what are our opinions on Ibogaine treatment for psychiatric disorders like obsessive compulsive disorder?
I understand that there are treatment providers that have used Ibogaine for OCD, or obsessive compulsive disorder. For our program, we don't specifically treat for something like that, but there are those who are chemically dependent who are often dually diagnosed. Now, that's a tricky issue for us because it can be considered dangerous with particular psychiatric diagnoses such as schizophrenia or bipolar. I would not administer Ibogaine to somebody knowingly simply because we do not know what could happen, and it being a very powerful psychoactive, it could have potentially adverse effects. So I wouldn't treat for disorders such as that, although we have had crack users who had been diagnosed, and I say that with the parentheses because it all, you know, which came first, the crack use or the OCD, and do they affect each other? Are they interrelated? I think so. So we have treated for that, or people for crack use who have been diagnosed with OCD. It's actually been a really difficult part of the screening process for me because some people feel they have to lie in order to get into treatment. And that, I think, is a product of discrimination against a drug user and a lack of access to services. And I try to encourage as much as possible people to be honest with us about that, because we don't want to put anybody's life in danger or their sanity in danger. So we've learned quite quickly that we have to check and double check with a doctor, with a therapist, with whoever we can, in order to find out about these sorts of things, because we don't want to hurt anybody.
This is an opportune moment to mention that, you know, as there is a lethal dose of Ibogaine, and there are people that aren't healthy enough to take it. If you have a heart condition, if you have a bad liver, if you have some other infirmity that you're just questioning, I would not suggest taking it. I've had bad experiences where we've had people get into the treatment center who we weren't aware of that had schizophrenic disorders. Now, aside from that, if you're healthy, if you're trying to change your life and you have an OCD you want to work on, go for it. That'd be my opinion. I mean, if you've had other positive psychedelic experiences and you can handle it, go for it. Sir, please.
You talked about sort of screening and what you try to avoid for your deficit. What are the adverse effects you have seen in treating people?
Adverse effects to the liver?
What adverse effects do you have seen?
We had one adverse psychological event where our subject or patient became quite agitated, claimed that he was experiencing withdrawal, became very paranoid and wanted to go to the hospital. So we took him to the hospital. We got him there within 10 minutes after he had asked us. This process took a while to unfold, took about an hour to unfold to the point where he was really agitated and wanted help. And once in the hospital, he let himself go completely into that and had an adverse psychological event, had a very difficult experience. They had to strap him down It was very difficult to communicate with him while he was in that state. The hospital administered a large dose of benzodiazepines, which took a long time to take effect. We've been trying to get to the bottom of the reason for this event, and the closest we have gotten to is that A, this person had lied again in his, during the screening process about previous experience with psychedelics. He'd always had bad trips. He'd had a number of bad trips. Every time he's taken a psychedelic, he had a bad trip. And when we talked about that, he said, yes, I have taken psychedelics, and he omitted the fact that he did not enjoy them at all. He had also been taking on a regular basis a substance called modafinil or Provigil, and contrary to a previous agreement to cease the use of this medication, which is something we have to do often with other medications beforehand, to stop the use of them, you know, to make sure that it's out of their system before, and that can be tricky. Just a moment, before I lose my train of thought and getting close. So we suspect, although there's no way to find out for sure, that the modafinil may have had an effect on that as well. I'm not quite sure what class of drugs modafinil falls into, but it's used as a stimulant, a sort of, it's used for narcolepsy, yeah. It's an alternative to amphetamine. To Xylert, Pemoline. Thank you. I didn't hear that. I don't know if that would contribute to an adverse psychological event, perhaps.
I think that, you know, what the other word of caution is, yeah. If you're on medication, you know, maybe you shouldn't be taking Ibogaine, because it is a new drug to us, and it's not studied well enough to sit around and start mixing it with things. There are other questions that need to be answered. Go ahead, please. The question is how does Ibogaine get metabolized, and do people metabolize it differently, and how do we know how much to give them? At the Ibogaine Association, we used to give a DNA test that there's four types of metabolizers. There's normal metabolizers that have a pair of enzymes. There's people that are fast metabolizers. They had three enzymes. There's people that are lacking an enzyme, so they're a poor metabolizer. And the people that don't have the enzyme. And for a while, we weren't treating them. And then we discovered that even without the enzyme, they will metabolize the Ibogaine just very slowly through a different process. And we were surprised to find out we had, you know, patients who, I mean, these guys take a hell of a lot of Ibogaine. You know, patients have taken it a few times, and they take more and more each time, and we think they're a fast metabolizer, and then turns out they're not, when we tested them later on. So we don't really have, I don't have the answers for that question yet.
These enzymes, these are liver enzymes we're talking about?
I'm not going to answer that for you. Please? All right, next question. No, we have answers. I mean, the science is there. Ibogaine metabolizes into a drug called noribogaine. And noribogaine is a long-lasting opiate agonist. if you're dependent to opiates, your opiate receptors in your brain are adjusted to being filled with opiates all the time, and there's normally there for your endorphins. And when you stop taking these opiates abruptly is when you get the opposite effects. So if you give somebody who's an opiate addict ibogaine when they would need their next fix, the noribogaine will attach itself to the opiate receptors, and it stays there for 4 to 12 weeks. And so while you would be going to withdraw, you're not, because the opiate receptors are filled, and the noribogaine will diminish slowly. Also, because the noribogaine's in your brain, it's going to decrease your cravings. So it gives these addicts a window of time to be without the cravings, to work on learning the skills to stay clean. It's also theorized that the ibogaine gets the communication going better across the corpus callosum, so that the two hemispheres of the brain can communicate better. It is a dirty molecule and attaches itself to several other places in the brain, so it is working with stimulants. Helps to regenerate neurotransmitters, and we believe that while you're on it, you mimic fetal REM sleep, so this gives you a good recharge. You got any question? The question is, yes. Have we ever experienced somebody have a bad reaction from taking the test dose?
Yes. I've seen a case where there was a rapid drop in blood pressure, and we found out after about an hour that this person had been on an undisclosed alcohol binge the evening before and was consequently dehydrated. One of the things that we recommend and that we try and enforce in any way possible while they're with us for the first 12 hours before they take, or for the monitoring period before they take the ibogaine, is to hydrate themselves adequately for at least a few days beforehand, because dehydration and ibogaine can cause a drop in blood pressure. Yes, we have. I've also seen someone whose heart rate jumped up to, it was like 120, like very quickly, and took about an hour to come down, and that could have been anxiety, but we didn't want to take the chance right away, so we waited. This individual did later decide to take ibogaine on his own and was fine. Although I wouldn't recommend you take it on your own, he did have a sitter. I meant he didn't do it through our treatment program.
Your question?
You got some research to do there.
Well, I want to change the focus here for a second.
I might answer that question. In a different country, I might answer that question. Right, did you take it?
In the 60s, when they outlawed LSD and psilocybin, they also outlawed ibogaine, and they put it in Schedule 1, meaning that it has no therapeutic value and it has potential for abuse. And both of those things are obviously not true. I personally would rather be working to end the drug war than to be working in ibogaine treatment. I've been doing ibogaine treatment for a long time now, and I like the social causes myself. But I'm seeing that ibogaine is going to be one of the catalysts, I'm going to keep using that word, for change that's going to happen to the drug war. There is such a surge in ibogaine popularity right now. At our treatment center, at other above-ground treatment centers, and underground treatment centers, and it's hitting the news, and people who would have no reason to know about ibogaine are knowing about ibogaine. They had ibogaine on CSI, and they did a whole piece about it. You know, the most publicity ibogaine ever got.
It was pretty good, actually.
Yeah, ibogaine rising. So what I'm seeing is that this. The absurdity of ibogaine being illegal is caught up in the absurdity of the drug war. So this is another avenue we have to go to our lawmakers and say, hey, we want ibogaine to be legal. We don't have the money. We don't have the time to put it through all these R&D tests. You know, the people are going to be doing it. They're doing it underground, and they're not doing it in safe situations. And ibogaine belongs in safe situations. It belongs in the treatment center in your neighborhood. It's not fair that they have to come to Mexico or go to Canada or do it underground and in risky situations. It belongs in the jails. When people get arrested, they should be have the option, you know, you can go kick in that room or you can take ibogaine in here with a nurse.
In Canada, we have a really interesting situation right now to open up dialogue about this because Vancouver, our city, has an official harm reduction strategy called the Four Pillars Harm Reduction Strategy, through which our city has implemented a number of different services that are aiming at reducing the harm associated with drug use and reducing the discrimination against drug users, and as well trying to educate and inform people about drugs. We've just recently opened up a safe injection site. It's been operating for a year and is going well. We've also we're just about to begin heroin by prescription trials in Vancouver as well, whereby we'll be they will be administering free heroin by prescription to 500 of the hardest chemically dependent to treat, hardest addicts to treat. And so Canada, or Vancouver anyways, is poised right now to take a deeper look into as many different potential options for assisting people with these issues around drug use. And so we are attempting to open dialogue with the city, and have been, and I have a meeting with some detox centers coming up soon, which is very exciting to me, about the potentials of ibogaine in the treatment of addiction. And we're currently, like, at the Iboga Therapy House, our task is threefold. It would be of great benefit to convince Health Canada and other interested agencies in initiating clinical research trials. That's part of what our study is about, or what we're hoping to use our study for. The second task for us is to develop a community-based non-profit model that is based on a holistic concept, which includes a number of different services available to the people who need to come through this program that will help to support them in making this change in their lives. And that's quite a task indeed, but we're working on it. And the third task, of course, is to open up dialogue in situations like this with people around the world, and to encourage you to take the time to talk to people about it, to engage, to inform yourselves, and to get the word out about these potentials, not only about ibogaine, but of other psychoactives, which many of us in this room, I'm sure, here can attest to the great potential therapeutic benefits of. So it's not only giving us an opportunity to discuss amongst ourselves what the potential of these psychoactives are, but to talk about plant medicines, earth-based medicines as well in general, and the potential that has for healing, for connecting with each other, for connecting to more, shall I say, earth-based understanding of who we are. That's taking it way beyond, but I'd like to encourage you to continue the dialogue.
We'll take a couple more questions and then we'll probably wrap it up. Please. The question is to Sandra, will ibogaine become a scheduled drug in Canada? And I'll answer your question after she...
I have not heard any talk of ibogaine being considered for scheduling. And before that happens, I would most definitely like to think that our work is moving towards preventing that from happening. If it were to happen, then I'm definitely prepared to find every possible way to open dialogue about that, to not allow that to happen. Basically, I'm hoping that our work will prevent that from happening.
The next question was... is promoting ibogaine to do it in our homes safe? Essentially, right? Okay. I'd say no. Especially when we're talking about using ibogaine for drug addiction. And we're talking about working with people who are sick, both physically and mentally. And you can't trust them to be respectful to the power of this medicine. Just like she said, people, you know, lie to get into the treatment center. You know, and if you know, we say, hey, you need to read this manual, you need to know how to take this dose, you need to be aware of these health issues, you need to drink all these fluids. And the next, you know, the first thing that came to my mind after I went through the ibogaine was, where's a shot of dope? You know, and we know that ibogaine with heroin is potentially fatal. So if we here's ibogaine in your home, I mean, we're asking for it. That's what I really want to see. I'm excited to see what will happen. And I hope it goes very positively with all the underground treatments, that it works in our favor, that the demand creates a situation where the treatments will move into treatment centers and under the care of professionals. I'm afraid of... it's going more in the way of the good old Timothy Leary days, when, you know, everybody starts doing it and then they start cracking down because fatalities start happening.
I'd like to add to that. My question is then to anybody who is considering taking it on their own, whether or not they would find it beneficial to have someone to help to monitor their safety, to be a grounding factor, a person who's there to help them to feel safe. It's not easy to take ibogaine, even while being facilitated. It causes ataxia, loss of muscle coordination. It can cause a lot of nausea. It can be a very difficult experience. It can also be a very beautiful experience. And even in the case of it being a very beautiful experience, I think that in the interest of not only feeling safe and grounded during your experience, but also potentially having support there in case you need to find ways to integrate the experience that you're having, that it's a good idea to have a friend with you. A friend, a professional, at least. I know that there are people who attempt it on their own. And my deepest piece of advice is to inform yourself, take the time to read through the treatment manuals that are available online at ibogaine.org, to discuss this with people around you, to let them know that you're planning for this potentially very powerful experience. And I would say this not only for ibogaine, but with any psychoactive. To take the time to tune in for it with yourself, to see if you're ready for this, to share your intentions for your experience with the people that you're with. You know, because you're not only sharing that with somebody else, but by stating that out loud to someone else, you're kind of saying it to yourself too. I think there are physical dangers, very important factors to be aware of, but also just to be intentional about your experience and to feel supported is really important to take that all into account.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was wondering if any of you have found any potential for Ibogaine to be therapeutic for life-threatening depression.
Life-threatening?
Depression.
The question is Ibogaine therapeutic for life-threatening depression? I personally wouldn't treat somebody in that situation. Personally. Just because I, you know, wouldn't want to. I don't know the outcome. And what if what they see is worse, and then they commit suicide a few days later? I'm not going to feel good about it.
If it's a life-threatening situation, then, you know, suicide intervention help is available out there. And, I think that first and foremost, that life-threatening, do you mean as in immediate life-threatening or over a long period of time? And there's a number of different factors to look into, of course. But I wouldn't give them Ibogaine to try and change that. I think that it's a lifelong process to tune in with yourself, and if you're depressed, time to start taking a deep look into yourself and seek that value within yourself. And if you find somebody or know somebody who's in a life-threatening situation, do your utmost to support them in becoming healthy again.
Well, you guys are looking a little bit restless. We've been talking for a while. We're here in the camp, so if you want to talk to us individually, feel free. A couple things, you know, back to the drug war, when George Bush loses the election here in November, we know that John Kerry's wife knows about Ibogaine. And we also know that some of the big funders to the anti-Bush movement are George Soros and Peter Lewis, and they're both very, you know, positive on drug reform. So there is hope. There's hope that we can have this legal, hopefully in the next few years. The other thing, I'm not sure if we're supposed to do this at Burning Man, but this research project cost us money. It cost MAPS money. And MAPS is a great not-for-profit organization. So if you're able to offer something to them, you can find them online at maps.org. And we're also camped right next door, so if you want to come by and have a coffee or a tea with us and chat, we'd appreciate it.
Sit here and continue this dialogue, and you know, with regards to not just Ibogaine but other substances as well, and the exploratory nature, then I think it's important to recognize that yes, there are projects like MAPS who are doing a lot to support this. So if you can find any way to support these organizations, to support MAPS, to support any of these projects and other organizations that are working towards raising awareness and changing the perceptions around drug use, then please, please, please do so.
Also, MAPS has volunteers working over at the sanctuary, which is behind the ranger station. So if anybody is having a psychedelic emergency and they need to sit down with a professional or somebody who they should trust, they should come visit one of MAPS staff over there or volunteers. Well, thank you so much for coming and listening to us talk.
Thank you so much. And first I want to say, you know that all the loud sound we were hearing? So sounded like they were right behind us. They were across the street. We were just picking it up like an antenna. Please join us tomorrow. We have talks by Bruce Damer, who's going to talk about the universal mind state, Michael and Mithoffer, who are talking about MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder and Groff holotropic breathwork, and Rick Doblin, who is talking about psychedelic therapy. Thank you.